Really glad to have the chance to be with you tonight. I always enjoy coming down for the lecture series that Jeff hosts here. It's a big blessing to me. I enjoy everything that I can learn. I've been calling it Preacher Fest for so long that whenever they announce it back home, they don't know what the name of it is. And I don't tell them either that I'm just coming down for Preacher Fest. But it's a lot of help to me. I enjoy being with the different preachers that come, and when I can to come here early enough to visit with you, to be with you on Sunday night. I was able to do it maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and I think I got here earlier tonight by about 2 minutes. So we're doing better. I really appreciate the way that you have helped me in the past. My family and I have been working in Albany now for 4 years, and it's a work that I've really grown to enjoy. I like the town a lot. There's a lot of people. In a recent poll that the American Bible Society puts out, and I mentioned this in the report that I think I sent it out earlier this week, but in a recent poll, they try to find the most Bible-minded cities in the nation, and usually they will post, you know, these are the top cities, and then they'll also post in the article, these are the bottom-ranking cities. This year, they listed all the cities, but they didn't highlight the bottom ones, because maybe cities didn't like that sort of credit, you know, that's what they're known for. But Albany is doing better and better. We are number 100. We're dead last. Albany, Schenectady, Troy metro area. So that's about nearly a million people who 10% say that they do read their Bible every week. Now, number one is hitting, I think, in the 40s or 50% of the people polled read their Bible every week. So number one is still not a lot of people. There's a lot of people not reading the Bible in those cities. But joking around with Simon, you know, when I found out how the city was doing, either that means I'm out of a job because I'm not doing it right, or it just means that this is the work that I need to be doing, and that's what I feel like. It's very hard to find people in Albany who want to read the Bible, but we do find some. Often when we do, they are not excited about what they read, or they have been reading it and they don't like some of the things that I'm trying to say about it, or when I bring them to a passage, they're surprised about what the Bible says. And so growth has been small, but it's solid growth. I'm really excited about the growth in the sisters and brothers in the church, though. A lot of women coming from other churches in the area and are appreciating good, solid Bible teaching. We've had people that move into the area for work, and you know, if for that alone, I'm really happy to provide an environment where a family can come and raise their kids in a good, healthy environment in a city that might not be very welcoming to them, but that they have a nice, welcoming church to be a part of. And so I really thank you for that, for your support. If you have other questions about how what it's like up in Albany, I'd be happy to talk with you after the lesson. But I just want to express my thanks for the way that you've helped me and my family for these years. The lesson that I want to talk about tonight is actually a part two. A couple weeks ago, I had talked about we have the phrase strong-willed. And whenever we talk about it with a child, we are usually talking about a child who wants that candy bar at Walmart, and they're pitching a fit. And we'll look and say, well, that's just a strong-willed child. And my wife was reading through some material, and the material is putting out an argument that's saying that that's actually not the evidence of a strong-willed child. In fact, that's really evidence to the contrary, that the child has no will. That a candy bar, you know, a pile of sugar is able to reduce the child to tears, means that they have no strength of will at all. It doesn't quite translate when we're talking about us trying to be adults. For an adult to have that same reaction over a candy bar would take a whole lot of strength of will to muster up the nerve to roll around on the floor in that way. But really what I want to stress is the idea of, if we are going to be strong-willed people, that doesn't mean that we're stubborn and obnoxious. It's just that we have been exercising our will and we can wield it in such a way that it does what we want it to do and in the right way. In the first lesson, I looked at Dinah and Jacob and Simeon and Levi. And there's no strong will in any of that. And Dinah went where she shouldn't have gone. And Jacob didn't want to make a big deal of something that really was a big deal. And Simeon and Levi killed everyone. And we might say, well, those are just strong-willed boys. Boys will be boys. You know, no, not at all. They could not control themselves. And so they went out and they destroyed. And Joseph, on the other hand, is someone who I think has strength of will from his youth up. And I think the strong-willed show control and a mastery of themselves, and particularly looking at the story of Joseph, through all the difficulty. And Joseph's story is just a story of difficulty. And his victory, and where he comes out the victor at the end, does not mean that it was going to be an easy life. He was still going to have a lot of challenges. And one key verse that I think is powerful to think about this is, so whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. Usually this is that, well, I don't know, this is a gray area, but I feel awkward about it, so I say it's a sin, I shouldn't do it. I want to look at this verse considering the idea of just personal responsibility. Yeah, I know I ought to do that, but I just don't want to. Well, then I'm sinning. And if I know the right thing to do, I need to do the right thing. And if I know that something is wrong, then I need to not do it. And Joseph is someone who demonstrates that. I think that he stuck to the commandments and he stuck to the word. In 1 John, which we've been studying on our midweek study, how many times does John say, abiding in the word and having God abide in you? And that idea of having that which you have known from the beginning abiding in you. And so when Joseph was in a foreign land, he showed that. He continued to trust in God. And when he was up on top and the victor, he remembered God and he didn't turn God away. If you turn to Genesis chapter 39, I want to look at a few verses. The stories that we're looking at, you should know. You can ask your preacher if you have questions about the story of Joseph, and he can do a big old series on that. I think that we need to be... Joseph is one of my favorite Bible characters. He's one of my heroes. And this chapter is one of the strongest on that for me, to showing how strong he was. In Genesis 39 and verse 1, now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, and an Egyptian, had bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. So this is, we're set up for Joseph, and he's there, and he's not where he wants to be, and he's been purchased, and now he's working for this guy. And in verse 4, Joseph found favor in the sight and attended him, and he made him overseer over all his house and put him in charge of all that he had. And that happens because of verse 3 is where I wanted to pick up. His master saw that the Lord was with him. And so either, I like to think that Potiphar is a decent guy, and he says, wow, here's a man who has the Lord with him, and so this is the right kind of man for me. Or he could have just been a good businessman and saw, wow, the Lord is blessing this kid. This is the guy I want running my business, and my business will be blessed. I don't know what Potiphar's like. But when we get into the story, it's not really about Potiphar. It's about Potiphar's wife. In verse 6, so he left all that he had in Joseph's charge. And because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. No, Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house. And he's put everything that he has in my charge. He's not greater in this house than I am. Nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her, to lie beside her or to be with her. But one day, when he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was there in the house, she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. This is the Bible story of strength of will. Now, this is it. This is a guy who is not thinking selfishly. This is a man who is able to look past his temptations and see that there's better things out there. These are the things, these are the statements that I can see myself thinking. I hope I wouldn't think these things. But it's not that big a deal. You know, when in Egypt, do as the Egyptians. I'm just a slave. Oh, she's my master's wife. I have to do what I'm told. You know, no one will know. I'm all alone. You know, I haven't been to church in months. That idea of the distance that we are from church makes a difference. I'm using the word church here in a pretty ugly way, right? It's a long way to Sunday. Or I'm on vacation. I haven't seen my preacher in a while. I haven't seen my mom in a while. And whether it's time or mileage, we feel like now the parameters and the rules all of a sudden change. So I might as well do this. And even this idea that he had to, which I think is one of our biggest lies. Oh, I just had to do it. When we get on a train that's going in the wrong direction, it takes a while for that train to pick up very much speed. And, you know, you might twist an ankle hopping off. But you can jump off that train anytime you want. And you get going down that path, and you think, I can't jump off anymore. This is just going too fast. 2 days later, you realize, I really could have. I could have back there. But I can't now. I know that for sure. 2 days later, you know I was wrong 2 days ago? But I know for a fact that today, there's no way I can stop what I'm doing. And we're just lying to ourselves and lying to ourselves, going farther and farther and faster until we convince ourselves that we just have to sin. You know, if Joseph had been looking at her, and then she asked that question, do you think it would have made a difference? If he had been noticing her, maybe thinking about her, Jesus talks about that idea of mental or secretive sins, those sins of the heart being just as destructive. When he says in Matthew 15:11, it's not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, but what comes out of the mouth. We have that phrase, going all the way. Oh, as long as I don't actually steal the thing, and I just sit around thinking about it and coveting it all day long, I haven't actually gone out and hurt somebody. And maybe that's the way Joseph was living, or he could have been living, I should say. Looking at this lady and thinking about her, or looking at anyone and thinking about them, and then this woman asks him this question. And if he had been thinking selfishly, if he had been thinking about fulfilling his own desires, it would have been really hard for him to say no. The answer that he gives her is long, and it's full of great reasons. And it's material reasons, and ethical reasons, and spiritual reasons. So we know that no kid with his mind on that stuff would have been able to come up with this answer. He had his mind on right. And he had been filling his mind with righteousness. Otherwise, I don't think Joseph could have come up with such a well put together answer. One thing that I feel bad for in the case of Joseph is that he couldn't just get a new job. You know? We can. I don't have to listen to her. I can quit my job and have a few bad weeks or even a few bad months looking for a new job. There's worse than 3 bad months without work, people. A lot of saltines and a lot of beans and rice is better than sin. And wrecking a family, even if it's not my family, that is wrecked. And we can leave a town and we can leave a job, but we think we can't. Joseph couldn't. I think about Lot. And that's one of the things that really gets to me about Lot. In 2 Peter 2:8, for as that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard. And I keep asking myself, you know, Lot, why didn't you move? And there might have been something or a good reason for him to be there, and I don't want to come up with that reason. Because I want to have it in my mind that if I'm ever in his shoes, that I will just pick up and leave. And maybe leave the shoes behind. Have an uncomfortable walk. We can avoid this lady's persistent speech. And I also think, and I talked about this a little bit earlier, that there is absolutely no corner that we back ourselves into that we can't get out of. And it's just the truth. We will suffer consequences. And trying to get out of that sticky situation is going to leave us sticky. But we don't have to sin. I see Joseph being busy working. Of course, he was a slave. He had to. But he was busy with that. I see him having God's words and the wisdom of God on his mind. So in whatever way he could be embedded in God's word, probably not physically, but mentally and remembering maybe things that he remembered from his father, that's the way he embedded himself. And that's what we need to be. Proverbs 7, don't go there, doesn't mean don't read Proverbs 7. I just looked at that and it occurred to me that it might come off in a bad way. He's looking out his window and he sees that poor kid. Or is he an idiot? You know, I go back and forth. Does the kid not know what's down that street, literally? Does he really not know? Because most kids hear about talk and hear about, I don't know what's down the street, but I know something's down the street. And so he's looking at his lattice and he sees that youth passing along the street near her corner. There's really only one time you can go by her corner and not know. And all those other times you go by her house, you know she's there. Or you might say, well, she's probably not home. But you know, I'm always interested in who's home and who's not home. This has nothing to do with, you know, who she is. We come up with these bad excuses and these bad lies to ourselves, and we try to tell ourselves that it's not going to matter. We don't know it's going to cost our life, as it did for the youth in the story. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 has the verse that I think that we're all familiar with. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. This is supposed to encourage us. It's not supposed to hit you in the head and say, look, see, you could have left. But if that's what it's doing to you, I'm glad. Because if you did it yesterday or 3 days ago, then you forgot that this is true. Oh, I had to do it. Well, that's not true. God is faithful to us. He's never going to let us be where we can't get out. We are able. He is faithful. His faithfulness is much more powerful than our own ability. And so we need to trust. Oh, it's just a taste. It's just this one time. It just really doesn't matter. These are all lies. And if we stick ourselves into God's word, if we abide in it, if we're reading it, and if we're meditating on it, then we will be able to come up with good answers. And sometimes the answers will be two verses long, and sometimes the answer will mean running as fast as we can. And those are brave things to do. Well, continuing the story in verse 13, and as soon as she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and he had fled the house, she called to the men of her household and said to them, see, he's brought among us a Hebrew to laugh at us. He came in to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And as soon as he heard it, I lifted my voice and cried out. He left his garment beside me and fled and got out of the house. Then she laid up his garment by her until her master came home. And she told him the same story, saying, the Hebrew servant whom you have brought among us came in to laugh at me. But as soon as I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment beside me and fled the house. And as soon as his master heard the words that his wife had spoken to him, this was the way your servant treated me, his anger was kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. We'll stop there for just a moment. We see her lie and his punishment. And what really strikes me before I move on is this idea of, man, what good was the obedience? I'm worse off now than when I obeyed. What good is it to obey? And I'm going to say something that a lot of people don't agree with, but I think there are stupid questions. Because the good in obedience is obedience. That is the result. What is so good about righteousness? That it's right and that it's righteous. And so, what's the good of being righteous if I get myself into pain and difficulties? that we are righteous and that we are with God and that we are like God. And that's something that we need to get into our minds. Well, continuing through, he's in the prison in verse 21, but the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. And whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. And so he is in prison and he keeps getting lower and lower. And the text tells us that the Lord was with him. And when I was looking at the lesson preparing for today, I was wondering, did Joseph know that? And I can imagine myself saying, is God really with me? I can see that question arising in my heart. I think this, the way that it's written and the way that he was blessed because of his good work, that I think he knew. And I don't know if he was getting a message or not, but I get the impression that Joseph did know that God was with him. I don't think he had to see a pile of fire at night or a cloud in the day to know that. But he knew that God was with him because I think that that is demonstrated in his behavior. Well, it continues through. In the next chapter, we have two men who are also thrown into prison and they have their dreams and Joseph is interpreting their dreams. And I want to just pick up in verse 13 when he's giving the interpretation of the dream that was favorable in verse 13 of chapter 40. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office and you shall place Pharaoh's cup in his hand as formerly when you were his cupbearer. Only remember me when it is well with you. And please do me the kindness to mention me to Pharaoh and so get me out of this house. For I was indeed stolen out of the land of the Hebrews. And here also I have done nothing that they should put me into the pit. And then jumping down to verse 23, yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. Next chapter, after 2 whole years, ... And so here Joseph, he's all alone. He's trying to do good. He is doing good. He's trying to be righteous. He is being righteous and he's getting punished for it. He's getting persecuted for it and he's getting more and more alone. And it seems that he knows that God is with him. He's able to interpret dreams because of knowing God. And here he has this chance. Here's a guy. I'm friends with him. He's going to get out. He's going to put in a good word for me. This is my chance. I've got to make sure that this works. This is my salvation. And it falls apart. And I can see myself saying, well, that's it. I'm done for. That's it. That was my chance. And the depression that could happen. And so we have this, what good is obedience? Look where it got me. Man, that is such a lie. Obedience is right. Is God really with me? And then along with that, and we have someone who's sick and really suffering right now, just, this hurts too much for me. I can't take this anymore. I don't want to put up with this anymore. My child is too sick. I don't want to put up with this anymore. My best friend is hurting themselves and I don't know how to help them and I don't want to deal with this anymore. These are these feelings that I think are similar to where Joseph was. And I can empathize with this. This is just too much. This isn't fair. I'm hurting and this is wrong. And then if I can just make this work, if I could just say the right words to this one man, then I can get myself out of here. I blew it. I'm a goner and I'm done for. The reality with all of this is God's always been with Joseph. From day one to day 101. Joseph's been interpreting dreams. He's been with God this whole time, even though the environment has changed over and over and over again. And if my view of God requires what I can see with my eyes to stay the same, I'm going to be in a lot of trouble. Because God was the same God to the Israelites when they were slaves in Egypt. He was the same God to the Israelites when they were wandering around the wilderness, and He was the same God to the Israelites when they got into Canaan. He's the same God to us today. He's the same, has the same heart, and He has the same care. And that idea of, is He really with me? I'm feeling all alone. When the Israelites were wandering around the wilderness, and He floated up in the air above them, burning all night long, they still had the nerve to say in Exodus 17:7, is the Lord among us or not? Come on, guys. He got upset about that. So apparently, even having the Son of God walking around performing miracles right in front of you isn't enough, because you can convince yourself to think, it's a demon, and blaspheme the Spirit in the process. So having God literally right here isn't going to be enough for us. And we have to trust in God beyond our physical environment and what we see. Another point that I think is a key to this is in 2 Corinthians 4:17. I think this is a passage that you probably know well. I think it's very powerful. For this light momentary affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. Going through verse 18. The reality of this verse is that when we present this concept to the world, and especially a world in turmoil and in conflict, it seems trite. But if we have trained our mind and our hearts, if we have exercised our will to trust God, when we are in conflict, this verse becomes the daily prayer that helps us survive. But it's going to take practice. You can't just say, ow, I stubbed my toe. Where's 2 Corinthians? I need to magically make this feel better. Because when you have something bigger than a stubbed toe, you will have had to think about this verse long beforehand. When cancer enters your family, or a car crash, or some spiritual loss, which is a lot worse, you will have to know that all of these troubles are light and momentary before the troubles hit. So that's the way that we need to prepare ourselves and think about us. And this idea of, this is my only chance, and I'm all alone, and I've blown it. I was trying to think, turn to Daniel chapter 10. I was trying to think of a story, where God heard His people and helped them. It's, you know, that's not easy to do when you've got the Bible to work with and trying to narrow it down. And I thought of, I don't think I've ever used Daniel 10 for this illustration before. All the kids love the first half of Daniel because that's what we teach them, but we're afraid to teach them the second half of Daniel. I think kids would love the second half of Daniel just as much or more. Because it's exciting, and there's monsters, and there's problems, and then there's God. And so Daniel's been praying and praying, and he wants his people to be free and to go back home. And in Daniel 10, verse 10, behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. And he said to me, oh, Daniel, man greatly loved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright. For now I have been sent to you. And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up, trembling. And then he said to me, fear not, Daniel, from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before God, your words have been heard. That's huge. From the first day, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, but Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I was left there with the kings of Persia, and came to make you understand what has happened to your people in the latter days, for the vision is for the days yet to come. And then he just goes off on one of those great visions. And we think, wow, ever since Daniel's been praying, the guy immediately set out to talk to him. It's been 21 days. Daniel had a lot of opportunity to think, I am all alone. That's it. There's my chance. 21 days later, he gets the message. And then he finds out that the explanation doesn't really make any sense. The lesson here is, we have no idea what's going on. The lesson here is, there is more going on than my stubbed toe. Paul says in Ephesians 6, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. We wrestle against the spiritual forces of wickedness in heavenly places. And I have no idea what that really means. This is one of the clearest passages we have of an actual fight going on. And I don't know what it's about. But the reality is, my problems aren't that big. To me, they are. And I don't want to diminish the pain of when I am sick or when you are sick. But we have to work hard to get beyond ourselves. Don't focus on yourself, because it's just going to hurt you. It's not going to help. Psalm 77 was a psalm that I was reading this week, and it's what I want to read right now. I mentioned this in my lesson earlier today, and I asked Simon about it, and he absolutely agreed. This is where the sermon slows down. So I'm going to try to keep it going. The first 9 verses is where the author is upset, and he's crying to God and saying, God, where are you? Really, where are you? Verse 10 is the turning point, and it turns out there's a lot of translation variations going on here, and so it's worded in some ways. Sometimes verse 10, your translation might have it hopeful and promising. Some of them might be a little bit more depressing, but there is still the turn afterwards. Psalm 77, I cry aloud to God, and He will hear me. In the day of my trouble, I seek the Lord. In the night, my hand is stretched out without wearying. My soul refuses to be comforted. When I remember God, I moan. And when I meditate, my spirit faints. You hold my eyelids open. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. I consider the days of old, the years long ago. I said, let me remember my song in the night. Let me meditate in my heart. Then my spirit made a diligent search. Will the Lord spurn forever and never again be favorable? Has His steadfast love forever ceased? Are His promises at an end for all time? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has He in anger shut up His compassion? Then I said, I will appeal to this, to the ears of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your wonders of old. I will ponder all your work and meditate on your mighty deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is like, great like our God. You are the God who works wonders. You have made known your might among the peoples. With your arm, you with your arm redeemed your people, the children of Jacob and Joseph. When the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. Indeed, the deep trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth thunder. Your arrows flashed on every side. The crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Your lightnings lighted up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was through the sea. Your path through the great waters. Yet your footprints were unseen. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. In our sorrow, the good thing that we can do is to read God's stories of salvation, know that He saves, trust in God, whether I ever see it or not. And that's the truth. I might not feel the relief physically, right? But I know that God has it there. And I know that God can do it. Chapter 41 through the rest of the book is where Joseph comes out on top. Joseph is the victor. I want to make a couple references here. In chapter 41, starting in verse 37 through 45, this is after he's spoken with the Pharaoh and the Pharaoh lifts him up. Or this is the process of him lifting him up. Verse 37, the proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house and over my people, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand and clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck. And he made him ride in the second chariot, and they called out before him, bow the knee! Thus he set him over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no one shall lift up hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah, and he gave him in marriage Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. And Joseph's finally the winner he deserves to be. Rags to riches story. Look at what Joseph did. He didn't do it, did he? It wouldn't have happened if Joseph wasn't a decent guy. It wouldn't have happened if Joseph hadn't worked so hard to know God. But Pharaoh is the one who's saying, you have the Spirit of God, and so that's why I want you. Of course, I think that might have been a bit of a temptation for Joseph. Egypt was known for taking men and making them gods. And so having the Spirit of God in me, practically makes me a god. And so I'm also second in command of Egypt. And, Pharaoh doesn't know anything that's going on anymore. He's just like Potiphar, just eaten. So I'm really in charge of this whole country. And when you get right down to it, we're the biggest country on the planet. So I am God, king of this earth. It's such an easy jump to get to. Right? But I don't think he does that. And he saves his brothers. He helps them out in chapter 45 when he sees them again. And he's done the test, and it's an interesting test. And he sees that these are guys who seems like they have a different heart. And he opens himself to them. He says in verse 3, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. So Joseph said to his brothers, come near to me, please. And they came near. And he said, I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now, do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and ruler of all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me. Do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children and your flocks, your herds and all that you have. There I will provide for you, for there are yet 5 years of famine to come. So you and your household and all that you have do not come to poverty. This is just unbelievable. This is the moment where I think so many people would just crumble and cave into selfishness and dwelling on what I deserve. And he didn't. Look at 50 after dad dies. Chapter 50, verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, it may be that Joseph will hate us and will pay us back for all the evil that we did to him. And so they talked to Joseph and plead with him. And in verse 19, Joseph said to them, do not fear. For am I in the place of God? For as for you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear, I will provide for you and for your little ones. Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Maybe we wouldn't have murdered our brothers, but we would have a hard time making their lives as pleasant as Joseph made their lives. I've got brothers. I got cousins. And I got you. It's not easy. Even when we do love each other, it's not easy. And he was able to get past this. Well, look at all that I've done and look at all that you've did. It's time for me to get my dues, and for you, you're going to get what's coming to you too. And he just doesn't react that way. One of the things that I think is key here is, we just rarely deserve any of the credit for what we do. Because 9 times out of 10, we're merely investing the talents that the master gave us to invest. So any of the returns we get, they ain't ours. They're his. And they are a reflection of his wisdom in giving us the right amount of money. And so, when we come up with our own plans, that's when we meet failure. So why can we just assume, oh, success, this must have been my plan? This is God who's behind the good things in our life. And we are absolutely never owed sin. You got to make sure that you know this and agree with this. I think that this is something that I struggle with. You know, I've been working so hard all day today. You know, I'm just going to do this sin. I don't think we're going to phrase it that way. I've worked so hard today, I'm just going to sit back. And I'm not going to do what I ought to be doing tonight. And I'm not going to be reading like I ought to. I'm not going to be talking with my wife like I should. I'm not going to listen to my kids. And I'm not going to do the work I ought to be doing for the family, for the house, or for you, and for you, and for you. And so, we might not say, well, you know, I've been a good Christian all week, so I'm just going to go out and party. But we might say, you know, I've been working hard all week, so I'm just going to sit at home and do absolutely nothing good at all. And think that we're okay. It's that classic American idea. Well, I'm not hurting anybody. The reality is that we often are. We're never owed sin. No matter how much good we do, no matter how much bad we've endured, we never earn the chance to get what we want in that sense. Vengeance is a big one in that category. And vengeance ain't mine. It is absolutely God's. And if I avenge myself at you, I have stolen God's property or stolen God's right or stolen His action, however you want to see that. And the reality is, He'll do a much better job than I ever will. And either I won't do enough vengeance at you, or more likely, I'll go overboard and create more hurt than what God's consequences could create in an individual. You know, we're not even owed salvation. I've done all this good, so now I deserve heaven. We know that that's not true. So don't think that you can just flip it upside down and say, I've done all this good, so now I can have some fun. We need to remember God when we are in triumph and when we are in victory. I think that will help us. I was trying to think of a good passage to emphasize this idea about that there is no retirement in being a Christian. I'd heard someone say, talking about, you know, different works in a church, particular Bible classes and things like this, and there was a Christian who'd said, well, we put in our time, now it's time for other people to do this. And I just don't think that that person had been reading Titus 2, where it's the older who need to train the younger. And it was older women with younger women. So we're not talking just training these little kids. You ladies need to be teaching you ladies. There isn't a retirement age for being a Christian. I thought of the Pharisees that Jesus was dealing with and the way Paul writes about that attitude in the latter half of Romans chapter 2, where it says, oh, you who know the law, and you're telling these people, oh, stealing is a sin. Well, are you stealing? You've lifted yourself up, you've raised yourself to the point where you know what is right and wrong, and you can just tell everybody and you can learn them good. But if you are doing those things, then you are wrong. We don't get to the point where we just kind of get to coast. That's really what I wanted to think about here. And if we clearly picture God, and if we picture God's work when we're in prison, when we're at work and we're tempted, then someday, if we ever are in triumph and are head of either the planet or a chess club, we will remember that it was God who was leading us every step of the way. And He's still there in front of us. In 1 John chapter 4, John says in verse 10, in this is love, not that we have loved God. Oh, I've been loving God for 20-some, 30-some, 40-some years. And then, who cares? Not that we have loved God, but that God, that He loved us and sent His Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God. If we love one another, God abides in us and His love is perfected in us. And so when you throw me in a pit, I need to love you. And I beg that if I ever throw you in a pit, that you will have the strength to love me despite that. And so what is strong-willed, and what is this all about? Again, I love this verse in James chapter 4, whoever knows the right thing to do, just do it. That strength of will, well, I know the right thing to do, then why are you saying it in that tone of voice? I know the right thing to do is the attitude that we need to have. And if we don't do the right thing, we're weak. We're weak-willed. And we need to stick to the commandments. We need to train ourselves to be ready for it. And I want to close by reading Hebrews chapter 10. I think that the book of Hebrews is written to answer really this whole issue of, man, this is getting hard. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this. This is a lot more work than I was wanting. This is harder than I thought it was going to be. This whole, you know, being righteous thing. And then the author of Hebrews comes in and says, have you really considered Jesus and how great He is and how good He is? And in chapter 10, verse 19, therefore, brothers, and he's about to list the good, since we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that He opened for us through the curtain, that is, through His flesh. And since we have a great high priest over the house of God, and there's other things that he could list, even from this book, let us draw near to God. Draw near with our hearts sprinkled clean and from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Is that Joseph? Is Joseph a man who could draw near to God when he was hundreds and hundreds of miles away from the people that knew God the right way? I don't know if he was baptized in this way. You know, we have that imagery there. But Joseph was one pure, clean-hearted kid who was drawing near to God. Verse 23, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. Joseph is one of the guys who was in the family that was getting these promises. And I can just see him having a stranglehold on those promises, holding tight despite how far he was being put down. And he was faithful to the one who was faithful to him. Verse 24, let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. I don't know if Joseph's brothers would even know how to do verse 24 and 25. It seems like maybe by the end they could. And Joseph had been working on that the whole time. So I just see Joseph in a lot of these things. We need to exercise ourselves so that we are ready for hardship and so that we will have a strength of will. We need to abide in God's Word. And it just stresses me out to think, not just that I live in a city where the people polled don't read the Bible, but that I have sisters and brothers who aren't reading the Bible. And that scares me. And I know what it's like to think I'm reading enough and then realize when I do a better job at reading daily and regularly that I had no idea what I was talking about a few years ago. We have got to stick our noses in the Bible and don't take them out. And have that right on the tip of our tongue so that when we are hurt, we'll trust in God. And when everything's great and we're about to puff up our chest, we remember God. And so we won't get ourselves into trouble, but we will keep ourselves with God. So it is my prayer and request that for myself, for my sisters and brothers in Albany, and for you here, that we will be a people that are strong-willed, that we are able to endure and not just, oh, I'm going to just dabble in some of these sins. It's not that big of a deal. There's no such thing. That we will know God's Word well enough to stay away from it. And that when we are depressed and alone and hurt, that we will just trust in God anyways. That's what it takes. And we can do it holding hands together. That helps. And we can do it by reading the stories of God's victory. That helps. And then, if everything goes right, pray that you don't forget God when it's all going right. Because that's what really ended up hurting the Israelites a lot, didn't it? May God bless our efforts to know Him and to trust Him and to remember Him. Thank you.